I would like to begin with some lines by Montali, a poet dearly loved by Linda Hall. He writes, "It is possible, you know, to love a shade, being shades ourselves. It is possible not only to love a shade, but to write in order to please a shade. For many years I have done both, and that shade I have loved and written to please is Linda Hall. I was present during the creation of most of her poems, and their first reader, and for better or for worse, their first critic. During our lives together, Linda constantly set a standard for poetic composition, which I have tried in my own way to meet. A standard that was always, as one of her poems puts it, ruthless, crucial, and exacting. To please a shade is no easy task. A fact we are reminded of again and again in Linda's poems, which are characterized above all by the ardor and sternness with which she herself loves the various shades who haunt her writing. As readers of her collected poems so acutely understand, Linda was above all an elegiac poet. She wrote to honor the audience of the dead, to give them continence, and wrote in gratitude for being spared their fate, at least for a time. And of course, as elegiac poets from Sappho and Archilochos down to those of the present day well know, they must write for the dead, but against death. Address, a section of Suite for Emily, Linda's longest and most sustained meditation on mortality, is comprised of 69 lines of the most searing invective against a personified death. Written during the height of the AIDS pandemic, its cadences are drawn not only from the grim headlines of the early 90s, but from Ecclesiastes and the Psalms. Your guises multiply, bewildering as the firmament's careless jewelry. Death, I have welcomed you into the rooms where plague has lain, when the struggle is past, and lit the candles and blessed the ash." Linda's poems insist, at times bracingly, at other times with the most keening sorrow, that the dead possess us in an almost shamanistic sense. Her poems exist to channel their voices, to give each figure in the photograph, each memento mori, its living name. These are the dead she evokes near the closing of the window, that effort which concludes her collected poems. Oh, phantoms, oh, the many lives that have fountained through my own. The phantoms in that astonishing poem are the source of inexplicable joy. They are the siren sisters who beckon, and who beckon with an even greater insistence now that we have learned to love them and heard their bewitching song. But Linda's poems tell us there are many ways to love the shades, and that our recognition that we too are shades may also take many forms. Consider the poem I would like to discuss today, Preparing the Estate Sale. It was one of Linda's earliest publications, included in her first collection, Ghost Money. Although she had not yet mastered the dazzling pyrotechnics and floridly undulating syntax that characterizes the later and better known poems of Star Ledger and The Only World, I often return to this poem because it possesses a serenity, a grave and steady approach to its elegiac mission, a music different from that of the later poems, but no less resonant. The tensions which the poem explore above all involve the challenges of empathy. As with the spare and starkly rendered characterizations of those outcasts and lost souls who populate Rilke's new poems volumes, dispassionate portraiture gives way to an almost involuntary empathy. The speaker is cataloging the effects of a deranged old woman, preparing them for an estate sale, an event which always has a slightly ghoulish character, but which in this case is made even more so by the melancholy evidence of the woman's years of solitary dementia. The speaker seems less to be cataloging Marie Brasseau's possessions as unearthing them. They are grave goods being released into this shocked air there's nothing delicate about. Here are the poem's two opening stanzas. This woman, this Marie Brosseau, and saved everything. A recluse receiving food stamp groceries, the medicines of old age. I must soak her figurines in water that darkens as dust floats from her skirts. Air will dry them, high summer, and the magnolias choking the house. Crystal wine stems glitter on shelves among dolls turned so their porcelain faces face the view the walls. Wash now, where Marie scrawled private arguments in China marker, opening in English, ending in the imperfect time of French verbs. But this damp, this kitchen, this plaster. How do I assess the last 20 years, the way she tested her eyesight daily with charts, the large E faltering over the stove, the vanity and the secretion of dresses? Generations of her hats litter the divan behind me, afternoon diminishing as I mark buttonholes and beaded purses in this shocked air. There's nothing delicate about these paper sacks on shelves in every room, vials of tannic acid, charcoal, and milk of magnesium, her universal poison antidote. As in so many of Linda's poems, the descriptions seek to fuse the tawdry and the sensuous. There's a lavish specificity to all the details, the figurines soaked in water that darkens as dust floats from their skirts, the dolls turned so their porcelain faces view the walls. Yet Marie Brosseau herself is evoked with a pitilessness that approaches revulsion. The speaker repeatedly seeks to distance herself from this woman, this Marie Brosseau, this damp, this kitchen, this plaster. Her goal is to assess the woman's life, a term which leaves little room for compassion. However, as the poem continues, the speaker finds that she must challenge this stance. The need to assess is replaced, slowly but inexorably, by a kind of self-reckoning and a reluctant tenderness toward the dead woman. By the end of the poem, the speaker has abandoned entirely her desire to merely profile Marie. Indeed, her shade has guided the speaker to her own discomforting vision of the afterlife. Polishing the legs of chairs, the only toxin is time. My face in the mirror, clocks throughout the house arranged by a private chronology, as if she could reverse the way our lives pass so gracelessly from our hands. She's younger in these photos than I am. 1925, Marie disembarks from France, New Orleans, her face under a cloche, eyes vague smudges. The dock must have smelled of oysters and chicory. Or here, she reclines on a wicker chaise, one of those green and cream evenings the South is famous for, deep June. She looks frankly at the camera, as if the future would be kind, as if her life could never drift unmoored. Marie, I'm talking to you now. I'm asking who will smooth the wrinkles from my dress. Will it be someone so unknown as to be past understanding? Someone discarding my husband's letters, these notes to myself falling, contagious as leaves in this green, hushed light that indicts everything. May they not judge us severely. The fate the speaker imagines for herself is, perhaps, as inconsolable as that of Marie. And yet the speaker's portrayal of the dead woman, changing as it has from coldness to empathy, somehow enables both fates to be more bearable. The reversal of the speaker's stance is hard won, and it is this very stubbornness on the speaker's part, her acknowledgement of the challenges and complexities of empathy, that is the poem's most notable accomplishment. It is a paradox one often encounters in the poetry of Hardy and James Wright, two poets whose work Linda knew deeply. Empathy may be our goal, but we first must be willing to judge our characters as severely as we must judge ourselves. This is a lesson Linda seems to have learned in this and in other of her early poems, and a knowledge which served her especially well in the magnificently accomplished poems of Star Ledger and The Only World. In one of those poems, Hospice, the speaker marvels at a drug buddy companion, beloved of the speaker both despite and because of her habit. How many times I watched you rise again and again from the dead. The shades who haunt the lives and afterlives of Linda's poems can do that. They can resurrect themselves, if only briefly. Thanks in no small measure to Linda's incantations, sorcery, and utter fidelity to her lyric gift, which was as great as those of any poet of our time. As Mark Doty wrote so eloquently in the afterword to The Only World, Linda's poems track the terrifying passage of having seen it all, remembered everything, turned from nothing. Linda did not live, but she did and does live to tell. She hammered out of herself something we cannot lose, a voice essential, dynamic, unmistakable. And I might add that this is why her shade so haunts me, and haunts me in a way that is indistinguishable from love.